Yeah, this is I got to interview David Pride this time, which is awesome. He's a really nice guy. Actually, I had to have a friend ask him for me. But yeah, I'm excited. We had to record this in the Forum because he's very busy, and it's the only time he had after a set at Comedy Nest. So sorry for the background noise. But I enjoy David Pride's a hilarious comedian, and enjoy him.
I find when I go down to the United States, it's just, I find as soon as they learn I'm from Canada, it's like Americans, it's like you all think that Canadians are these meek, apologetic people, and it's a stereotype that offends me, because, it's also a stereotype to say you all think that. I shouldn't put it that way. I should say most of you think that we're meek and apologetic, and I don't have the numbers to back that up. I can't say for sure it's a majority. I should really be saying a lot of you think that. It seems like a lot. Anyway, it seems to me, which is my perception, I'm probably oversensitive, but actually, probably a mistake to mention it, really. Yeah, so I'll tell you what, if you don't think we're meek and apologetic, I'm sorry I brought it up, really.
Okay, so we're back.
All right, well, yeah, we got turfed out of the...
Switch, we got switched.
We got switched over, because apparently the too many little children were... it was kind of creepy, us sitting around, surrounded by all those children.
Coming out of the bathroom.
Coming out of the children, running out of the bathroom. And that's what it takes to call security around here, so...
Okay, so let's start fresh, I guess.
Okay.
So, what year did you start comedy? And what age were you?
I consider my start 1998, because that's when I started doing open mics regularly in Montreal. The first time I went on stage was actually in 1997. So technically I did 8 times on stage before where I thought I like sort of started in earnest, but it was like... Yeah, like 8 times over 8 months sort of thing. And then I...
Also, 98 was the ice storm, so it's a great year.
Yeah.
It's a great year. I started during the ice storm. The ice storm got me into comedy.
Exactly. Yeah.
So where was your first time? Let's say open mic. Was it somewhere in Montreal or...?
The first time... Well, I was in Halifax. So I just did it at a pub in Halifax because I wanted to try it out. And it's nice to do it in a city where not many people know you, so you just... try it out there.
Just you didn't drive to Halifax to do it, did you?
Yeah. It's a forget Kingston. That was a real commitment.
I got to drive so no one knows me over here.
Yeah.
So when was your first like, I'm good at this moment?
Well, the very first time I did it, I got laughs. So that and the people I was with thought that was for your first time. That was really really good. And so they kind of planted in my head that you should do it again. There's some potential there, and then the second time it also went well, and then I think maybe the third time was sort of a little reality check, but it was kind of too late. I think it really helps when the first
time is really good.
If the first time goes well, you kind of get a taste of that, and so I wasn't discouraged, and then in 1998, when I came to Montreal and I did an open mic at the Comedy Works, and that went well also, and so yeah, I was kind of locked in at that point. I was gonna keep doing it,
struggle it out. When did things really start coming together as when you came from going from an open micer to an actual real comedian? Because a lot of people are really interested in that kind of transition.
Yeah,
how to do that.
Yeah. Well, I got Jimbo, who used to run the Comedy Works. He pretty early on, he let me go up and do a weekend. Like within the first year, which was nice, a nice vote of confidence. And then not too long after that, like a middler canceled, then he called me up, and so I got to do it again really fast. And I was starting to. So I was sort of getting a bit of that exposure, because the first time you do a full weekend, in this case it was 5 shows, and when you've never done that before, it's pretty intense to do like 5 times in 3 nights and just going up and experiencing that, early show, late show.
Oh, the huge difference.
Yeah, and I remember going home and just like, I had my little notebook out, and I was like, because I did really well the early show, and then the exact same material bombed in the late show. I remember scribbling, like, why? What is the secret? I was sort of lamenting to myself, how can this happen? And it's weird because you start out thinking, okay, well, clearly the solution's to have your early show set and your late show set, which doesn't really work that way. It was more a matter of just getting so comfortable,
battling through,
and just selling everything, and gradually you amass enough material that you can kind of pivot one way or the other depending on what's happening with the audience.
It's really so. Almost a year in, you were doing weekends.
Yeah.
And they say everything. The ball started rolling there, and you really.
Yeah. And then I did it Just for Laughs in 1999. The Homegrown, they put me in for that.
So a year basically, or 2 years technically, but a year of you kind of thinking you were in Just for Laughs.
Yeah. And I did the Homegrown, and I won it in 1999.
Wow.
So that helped too. I was still really new. Like I had like maybe 10, 15 good minutes to my name. So it was really cool, but there wasn't, in a way it was too much too fast, because there wasn't a lot, I couldn't, you know, go on a headlining theater tour across the country, because I still just had my little, you know, few good jokes here and there.
Did you feel after that, you just mentioned that you couldn't, did you feel like after that you may have been more than you can chew after the JFL, or did you know, like, hey look, I know, I just did JFL and one Homegrown, I know where I am, or were you like, I can do it, and
I wasn't in any hurry after that. And I remember a couple of comics sort of saying, yeah, no, you know now that you've got it. But, like, I wasn't in any hurry to go out and bite off more than I could chew. I was just like, it was sort of weird. It was getting, like, a taste of success, and then, okay, now I'll go back to reality and just yeah exactly.
Back to, middling on the weekends. Or?
I remember my next gig after that was like this little bar off Saint Jacques, and
only
it was like, yeah, this act just won the Just for Laughs. Give it up for, and it's like, you know, eight people, there's nickel slots going in the background, and it's like
they could not care less that you're there.
Yeah, exactly.
But that JFL, does that, a lot of people ask, like, does that JFL credit mean a lot? Did it help you out exponentially, or were you kind of on the same kind of path, do you feel?
It helped me get in with Yuck Yucks, which helped, you know, that gives you a lot more stage time in different towns and stuff.
Yeah, it's really...
So that was very useful. And, it probably helped. I did a Halifax Comedy Festival pretty soon after that. And that, you know, one probably had to do with the other. So it gave, it gave a little bump, a little couple of extra opportunities. But within a couple of years, it's, you kind of slide back to, like, what have you done lately sort of
thing.
Yeah.
So you established, you started in 98. By 99, you were in JFL.
Mm-hmm.
What year was your first hour, and how did you kind of feel about that the first time you did, like, your first...
First hour?
Yeah.
I don't know about hour. Like, 45 was kind of the sort of... The headline set sort of thing.
The first time you were like headlining, were you kind of like, oh, or were you kind of prepared for it? You know, were you?
I was pretty nervous about it because I did feel like I was gonna have to throw in everything I got, and even then kind of stretch it a bit, and that was at the Comedy Nest. I think Ernie let me do a headline weekend in like 2001, and that was interesting because he sort of. It was sort of the same as the early show, late show dynamic still applies, but now you're up there even longer, and you've still... So, I'd have some good shows and rough shows, and it feels like headlining sort of a different beast a bit. You sort of figure out about pacing things a bit, or, you know, whether you... Different audience might have to pack a lot of hard-hitting jokes top-heavy in the front just to get a bit of wind behind you, and then...
That's honestly really great to hear. Because I love... In comedy, I think I'm always, like, a big proponent of... Even when I book smaller shows, like, I'm a big proponent of giving the comic enough rope to hang himself with.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm a big proponent of, like, giving a guy a chance to do something as opposed to keep putting him, like, oh, you're still in the five-minute range.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I guess it all depends on... from the business perspective or whatever.
If you have a dead weekend, I guess.
Yeah. But, you know, it's definitely good to give people chance. That's what Montreal is kind of cool for, all the satellite rooms and stuff. Like, it feels like people do have... Because I remember, you know, there was open mics, gave you, whatever, 5 to 7 minutes. And then the weekends would give you 15, maybe, which was a good chunk. 15 was definitely a good chunk to work with. But yeah, but then there are other times you want to stretch out. Well, I wonder what it feels like to do 20, and if there's no stages early on, there's no opportunities to do that, except maybe like the satellite rooms. And
for sure, I was. But what did you ever feel like? What was the transition from? Because everyone I speak to, I legit every comedian who started, points to you as one of their favorites. Points to you as one of the top.
Cool.
Did you ever feel that kind of transition to be like, I'm kind of like just comedian to where like I've kind of, people look to me for advice now, or look to me as the.
I don't know if I noticed any transition like that. Like, I'm pretty pretty myopic and narcissistic that way. Like, I just am kind of just trying to figure out what I'm doing, and it's funny, I get kind of uncomfortable sometimes when people ask me for advice, because I don't always I'm kind of in my own head, and I'm suddenly like, oh, I'm watching someone else, but I don't always, for me it's so much about trial and error.
Yeah.
That, you know, I watch someone said, and it's like, yeah, that joke didn't work.
I've never had the confidence to ask someone to watch my set.
Yeah, no, actually, I don't think I have either. I don't, because I kind of feel like you learn it all while you're doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not to say I haven't gotten good advice from people who just watched my set anyway.
But I've never gone out of the way to be like, hey, can you watch my set?
Because
I feel like that's a bad omen, too. I feel like you're always going to set yourself up to...
Well, not necessarily, but it is tricky. I mean, I think there are some comedians that are very good at critiquing and sure. Like very, have a lot of knowledge of it. For me, it's so much of it's just throw it, everything at the wall
and see what works,
see what sticks.
Because a lot of times in that regard, I remember Mike Ward was, he's hosted Nasty Show last year.
Sure.
And he was always at Yuck's, like every week. Going over it, and I mean, he was just there, and he'd always just, I would never say like watch my set, but he'd always just like, after just introducing myself, saying hi, hello, I'm a huge fan.
Mm-hmm.
And then and he would just watch each week, give me advice each week.
Yeah,
like,
cool.
Really nice advice. Give
Very
me advice
cool.
about people like getting angry at you. It's like ignoring people that get angry at you.
Yeah.
Have you ever been the target of people saying, oh, that's not good to say? Or
oh yeah a little more lately, because I've kind of been veering it more interesting, kind of politically incorrect waters lately. So yeah, that definitely happens. And the first time it happens, you know, when it's early on in your career, it does sort of hit you. Like, you feel like you've done a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because especially, you know, it's often coming from someone older or someone, and yeah, you're feeling like you're getting scolded. But just, I think just with experience and with just getting relaxed in your own skin, I feel pretty comfortable now. I still listen to it if I get criticized like that, but it's there's no real you don't put up with the scolding as much, because what you're doing is, I mean, I don't really believe in any sort of censorship or anything like that.
For sure.
And I just love stand-up, because it's just, every joke you do is like a social experiment.
Yeah.
And I don't really agree with anyone who just flat out says, no, stop doing that. Again, like we were just saying, you know, if something bombs, you know it. So you don't need someone to tell you, hey, that joke wasn't funny. But if something does well, and then they're telling you, no, don't do that.
For sure. Room for 30 people enjoyed it, but the one guy who doesn't.
Yeah. And again, you can still take that. Listen to that and just try to process it, but you don't have to automatically throw yourself under the bus and be like, I'm a terrible person.
When people complain, do you is it, because I've personally seen from when I, because I've been like hitting up the open mics, just watching. I watched since I was like 16, 17.
Yeah.
And now I'm like 24, 25. I started when I was like 20-ish, well 18 really, but like 20, right, so seriously. And I feel the change. Do you feel it's more people, like this audience member, or do you feel it's more comedians on policing it? Because I feel that the transition the last couple of years, it's more comedians who are policing other comedians.
Oh, you know, I don't think I've noticed that. No, I definitely think it's comes from an audience. like
majority of people I've been yelled at by, it's always other comedians.
Oh, really?
And the transition, it's always like, like I tell this to people who are, it's like I'm never rude about it, but I'm always like, hey, let's talk about my joke, and as opposed to just, you are where it comes from, not a negative place at all.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more character based.
I mean, it is definitely, I mean, comedian advice or comedian input's definitely worth 100 times what the average audience member's advice is worth. They might see something you're doing wrong, or like that you're coming at too hard from some angle, or so it's probably worth listening to, but I don't know about if you feel like you're being policed. I think, I mean, that's kind of creepy to me, but
it's how it's done for me. It's always if the person's coming up to me and yelling at me for something, where it's like, you clearly have a personal stake in this and not policing the joke. As opposed to someone's like, hey, can I give you some advice? That joke comes off a little more racist and clever. Maybe you
want to
change it.
For sure, for
sure. That I always listen to. That I'm like, oh, for
sure. Okay, that's good.
But if it's just like, you shouldn't tell that joke, I'm like, why?
Yeah, yeah. No, I have a problem with that. Sort of a blanket sledgehammer approach.
Yeah, especially with... So we covered 98. By 2001, you're doing your first 45 headliner set.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of just go over the, when did you feel like the confidence to start doing 45, confidence to, like you said that recently that you've more kind of gone over to territories that maybe as a younger comedian you wouldn't have mm-hmm. done. When did you kind of feel that confidence where like I can say, you know, these controversial things and I'm good enough to do it?
See, I've only really felt, it's only since like 2012 that I've really started to feel really free to just like go nuts about stuff and you know, like take chances and just I think to be honest, like headlining, I'm still not a huge fan of headlining. I love running into the show, just blah blah blah, and just punch out and get out of there. It's there's like this responsibility when you're anchoring the show. And when it doesn't go well, like it's such a crappy feeling when if you let the whole show just like collapse into the swamp, which I've done before, and it's not a nice feeling, but just it was around 2012 when I just sort of came to a decision that I was no longer going to try to be the funniest comedian I could be anymore. Now my new goal was to be the most comfortable comedian I could be. And just when you go up with just, don't be too precious about the set. Don't worry, you know, because I found that on a given headline set, it's going really well. And your brain starts like, okay, don't screw this up. And then, you know, you hear someone start to chatter and you're like, oh man, no, don't mess up this pristine Fabergé egg of a set that I've got going here. And somewhere around the time I decided just to be the most comfortable, I decided don't get precious, just let anything happen. Just be just so happy on stage that just a bus could drive through the wall and you'll just act like it's the most natural thing in the world. Just acknowledge it or whatever. And I found sort of once I got that in my head, in the last 3 or 4 years, I just found it made such a difference of going up on stage and even if the show doesn't go great, it just doesn't bother you as much, because I it was good though. But like you're saying, we're sort of doing the chronology from 1998 to 2012, so that's it took me 14 years to have that little epiphany.
That sounds like such freedom when you say something. That sounds like the reason I wanted to be a comedian for so long, just like that freedom, be comfortable, because you go through life and you're always taught not to be comfortable, taught like, oh, but then when I got into comedy, like, I wanted to feel that, and that's kind of the dream, much more than anything else, to feel that kind of freedom to do it,
to
play what I want.
Yeah, yeah, and it's still tricky, you still have to sort of be critical of yourself and still, you know, we were talking before about recording ourselves, like, you still gotta listen and try to figure out what's working and what's not, and you don't just let everything run wild, and then, I mean, it's good to look like you don't care, but you still have to care, and you can still do that and kind of have it both ways. You can have be really comfortable, but also scrutinize yourself.
I love that feeling. I know. I love the feeling of Because, like, what other place in my life would I be able to go to Kingston and tell the whole town that they're stupid? And have the whole crowd laugh at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's always that freedom. But, you know, like I said, like, recording my set, that part of it, but the also part of the freedom, it's always, as a comedian, that's part I love more than the laughter or the people saying you're funny. Just the part I can get, like, one part of my life I can get on stage. And it's not what I always say about comedy. It's not a place for people to accept you. It's a place for you to accept yourself, and that's where the best part of comedy.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. There's a huge amount of just sort of like this is how I feel, and then you just like throw it out on stage. I find I'm doing that like at these open mics I come to. It feels like more and more I'm having these opinions about things, you know, about the world we live in. And it's like, okay, I'm going to express this, come to open mic, express this opinion. I have some jokes, right? I have some funny little add-ons to get in there, but I'm just going to sort of lay out how I feel about all this. And then, you know, go home, listen to the recording, see what parts people laughed at, what parts were just me talking to myself and just, you know, probably feeling really clever about myself, but no one was laughing. And then you just kind of sift through that and think, okay, these parts that people laughed at, why don't I just jam them together? I'll casually remove the parts that were just me, save it for the blog. But it's sort of cool. Like, I love open mics because it's, yeah, you get to, you just sort of vent all your stuff and then figure out what amidst all that jibber jabber you just said,
what works,
what was funny.
I consider open mics to be, because I did my first podcast with Wasim Almanzar. He's a very funny guy. He compared it to, like, with for example, learning the guitar. You don't invite people to your house to watch you struggle to play the guitar. So I consider open mics to be that place where people can screw up. You can whiff a little bit.
Yeah. You're tuning the instrument.
That's why when people are kind of like, oh, we're gonna ban you from an open mic. I'm like, it's there for people to get better. It's there for people to kind of learn how to do stuff. You kind of get mad at them and don't invite them back. How are they ever gonna get better?
Yeah, yeah.
You're just basically punishing them to be mediocre for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely go to open mic to take chances on stuff. And sometimes it's a matter of, maybe there is a bad joke, but you just got to get it out of your system. Just go on stage, say it once.
Oh, you know it too.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, that was bad. And a great joke might come out of that. Like,
well, I mean, it's happened that I've gone with that intent and then had the room erupt with laughter. And wait, this stupid joke actually works. And next thing you know, you're doing it on television, and that's it.
What was the first time you saw yourself on television? Was it like, oh my God, was it like you invited people to come see, or was it just...
I remember it was really, it was for Global TV, and it was a Montreal show in town. It was like a benefit show, but it was like local, like Global recorded it or whatever. And so it was on TV, and I remember it was a big, it was the first time I realized, because I did the set, and the set went really well. It was 7 minutes, and it was, you know, really fun, and the audience reacted well. I thought, that's great. That's going to be recorded for
TV,
you know, immortalized and all that. But then you watch the show, and you realize, wow, they edit the crap out of that thing. And sure enough, it was all they took out some of my favorite jokes, and they just shifted stuff around, and it was... went from 7 minutes to like 3.5 or whatever, and it took me like a couple of times to see that and realize, oh wow, I gotta lower my expectations. and since then, I just, you know, I remember the live performance, and I just keep hold on to that memory, and half the time I don't even watch the TV thing because I know it's just gonna piss me off.
Oh, TV. That's a dream for some comedians to do stuff on TV, and they don't think about, hey, like, your set might be edited, you know, they might take stuff out that they didn't like.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I guess, now again, you get sort of perspective, so now I can kind of look at it as, well, it's a nice opportunity, but at the same time, I don't get super overexcited about it.
They took out my favorite stuff. So someone told me you're really into comics.
Like comic books?
Yeah.
Mean? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. What's your favorite title of all time and right now?
Well, I don't. Well, what is it now? Like, of all time. Well, my trifecta growing up was X-Men, Daredevil, Swamp Thing.
Swamp Thing. That's a.
Yeah, yeah. Swamp Thing I came to a little later, but yeah, that was amazing. Like the Alan Moore stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But like since I was a little kid, just X-Men, Daredevil, those two things. Because I was starting to get into Daredevil right when Frank Miller was doing it.
Oh, and so that's when they changed to red, right?
Oh no, he'd been red for many years, but oh. It's just when it went really seedy, like gangster movie, film noir
stuff.
It got
really dark. And
yeah, really
everything
dark.
Bad was happening to Matt Murdock.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, I haven't collected for like, I haven't purchased comics for many years, but I've since discovered our local library has this amazing graphic novel collection, and so I decided I didn't want to clutter up the house anymore with actual physical copies, and I didn't want to waste all that money, so I just borrow graphic novels. But I don't really do Marvel or DC anymore because it's been rebooted and rehashed.
Can't invest anymore.
Everything, yeah, no, nothing. Like when I was growing up, everything, it was all one ongoing tale, and everything had cool consequence, and yeah. Heroes would die and you wouldn't see them again. It'd
for
be
a
like,
couple of years, not just three issues and they come back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now every story seems like a what if from Marvel and DC. It's like, well, you know, oh, that's kind of a cool scene, but who really cares?
I'm not into the main universe stuff. I think the one shots are excellent. I think the only run within the last 4 years is Snyder's run on Batman, which is pretty good.
I read a little bit of that. Yeah, yeah.
It's really good, but the new 52, all the things were terrible. The costumes, everyone was wearing a turtleneck for some reason.
Yeah, I didn't see. I was gone by then. No, I mostly collect like independent stuff.
Yeah.
You know, stuff with little confined universes that you can actually read it from beginning to end, and there's no reboots or weird. Company-owned characters.
Yeah, there's a lot. I'm really trying to read every Crow that came out.
I've never read The Crow.
Starting from the original one, I picked up some of the actual novels of it. I'm trying to read every single one because they're pretty good. Some of them are better than others, but I prefer that to reading it, DC and Marvel.
Yeah.
I still have them in my house, DC Marvel, but it's like I don't.
Well, I still buy old, you know, 70s, 80s DC and Marvel, especially Marvel. I was mostly a Marvel kid growing up. So I'll go back in time and I'll nostalgically like buy an old dusty copy of something.
Oh yeah.
I still love doing that. It's just all the modern stuff I've kind of sort of written off.
Have you seen the showcases they have, where it's like a run from like 68 to 78?
Yeah, in Marvel it's the Essentials, Essential volumes. I've read a couple of those.
Those are great. There was a comic book store in the West Island that was going out of bankrupt. I remember I picked up all the Essentials and all the showcases.
Yeah, yeah.
For like, they're usually $30. Got them for $2 each.
Oh, crazy.
So I basically have like the Teen Titans like original run to like now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just so fun to look, because they're so much better back then.
A lot, and in some ways they are. But I mean, a lot of it's, I don't know. Yeah, just, I'm going through, a friend of mine gave me some old Avengers that he'd found that he didn't want anymore. And they were like from issue like 93 to 105 from 1971, 1972. And they're just fun to read, and some of them are really corny and stuff. But you kind of remember anyway, like how, you know, how cool that stuff was when you were a kid, and you kind of you forgive a lot when you're going back looking at stuff nostalgically.
I love 80s X-Men. Anything in the 80s with X-Men
that's,
is my favorite.
That's when I was collecting it. Just all Chris Claremont stuff.
The 90s, I jumped off a little bit.
Yeah, me too.
Anything released from like 81 to like 89, I'm in love with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wolverine in a brown and orange costume.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. I just discovered the website, the Super Mega Monkey. I don't know if you've ever.
What's that?
It's a guy reviewing all the Marvel comics chronologically from like 1961 he's as far as 1992 now.
Wow.
He's just reviewing every single Marvel comic.
That's something I'd spend like hours watching.
Yeah, yeah. I've discovered it maybe a little less than a month ago, but I spent a lot of time just clicking through old comics, and yeah, that's fun.
I love going to the comic shops that sell like the old ones, the older
I love, yeah, back issues. I love flipping through back issue bins.
Back issues are, especially like Green Arrow's Green Arrow in the 80s with, was it Moore took over?
With Mike Grell?
Yeah, Mike Grell's run.
Yeah.
Where it's the Longbow Hunters, amazing.
Yeah.
I remember I went to Comic-Con last year, and they have usually those dollar comics, and I found the entire run issues. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, oh my god, I gotta take this.
Yeah.
It cost me like $5. As opposed to, I also have the paper, graphic paperback, but I'd rather have the issues in the artwork. It's so
yeah,
great.
Yeah, you gotta smell those things and just
it's
be immersed in the past.
It's so great. So, growing up, before getting comic, who are some of like you guys you just loved?
For comedy?
Switch back to comedy.
I listened to Bill Cosby. Like, he was the first guy, like, it was a vinyl record, and, like, the first person, like, my parents explained, yeah, this is a comedian, this is what they do. You know, just listening to that, and, oh, that's what that is. And then a big one was Let's Get Small by Steve Martin. That album, crazy.
I have that in my house, because I went to a used bookstore, and they're selling CDs, and someone had Bill Cosby, had a bunch of Carlin CDs when they first released them. I picked them all up for 33 cents each, and they're just amazing.
Yeah.
Steve Martin was just amazing. And just, it's sad to see his like kind of hatred for stand-up now.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. He's a bit above it now, I guess. Or feels he is, I guess. But, I don't know. I mean, maybe I could understand that.
So Steve Martin, Bill Cosby.
And the hugest one was Monty Python. Devoured Monty Python stuff. That was a big, big influence.
Who was your first comedian you went to see? Like a big famous guy that you went to see? Someone who was not like an open mic, but someone you purposely bought tickets to see.
I didn't really do that until... Oh, you know what? Actually, that's not true. I bought tickets to see the Kids in the Hall. In town here at the old Club Soda, and that was actually really, really cool, like an experience of just being in a live comedy show, and it was very electric and exciting and fun. And I just met Scott Thompson a couple of years ago, and like we were on a show together, and it was kind of funny because we're sort of like, have we met before and stuff? No, I don't think so, but we were just going backstage. And then it just sort of hit me, wait a minute, yes, we have met before. I got your autograph in 1991. And that kind of floored him a bit, like, oh, that's kind of cool.
How good does that feel, though, that to be, like, people you see, you went to go see, you saw on TV, bought tickets to see that you're on the same show as them?
It is pretty cool, for sure.
That sounds like such the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, I remember very vividly when Derek Edwards, who I love, he was headlining the works, and I got to MC for him, and it was like quite early on my like career or whatever. But yeah, I have a very vivid memory of like the show, you know, being packed and everyone, you know, and I'd done my bit, so I was had a beer in the back of the room and was just watching the show and just listening to laughter. You know, Edwards in there and everybody and just suddenly it hits you like, oh wait a minute, I'm in this show, like I'm a part of this, and that it was like a very cool feeling.
That sounds honestly like I say, it's been great talking with you, David. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah,
I really
thank
appreciate
you
it.
Oh, no problem. It's fun to talk about this stuff.
Thank you very much. You can catch David anywhere around town, basically. See you everywhere.
What's coming up? I'm gonna well, I don't know when this is going out, but Comedy Nest is having a St. Patrick's show this Sunday, and I'm going to be in that March 20th.
I'll get this out for Saturday.
March 20th. I'm at Comedy Nest St. Patrick's show, and otherwise, yeah, I'm always around. DavidPride.com, at DavidPrideJokes on Twitter. And
he has a hilarious album on iTunes.
Yeah, Sight Gags. David Pride Sight Gags, which you can check out. And I have a one before that called Googly.
Hilarious. Check them out.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you very much.